Life versus killing, Exodus 20, verse 13. We move on to the next of the Ten Commandments we've been studying. Thou shalt not kill in the King James, but of the different English translations available today, almost all of them translate this as you must not commit murder. Best of my research shows that only the King James Version, the Old Revised Standard Version, the New Jerusalem Bible, and perhaps a few others, render this passage, you must not or you shall not kill. Now, in the King James Version, there are 10 different Hebrew words that were translated with the one English word, kill. And of those 10, 9 of them include the concept of murder of any kind of lawless killing, which is the case we have here in verse 13 of Exodus 20. But in the opinion of some Bible scholars, these more recent translations do us, the readers, a disservice by having this read, you must not commit murder. Even though that is what is in view here, there's more at stake here than just that. Because murder typically restricts the meaning to exclusively human life. But in the wider application of God's law, the restrictions include all kinds of life, not just human life. Now, the emphasis of my message today will be on what God's law means to teach us regarding the taking away of human life. But before we take up this side of the law, it's very important for us to understand the wider implications, the wider application. And that's what I was getting at in my comments just now. Yes, even though this technically in the Hebrew terminology refers to committing murder, there's a reason these older translations and a few of the newer ones have it rendered kill. Turn with me to Genesis 9, verses 2 to 4. This is the covenant that God is making with Noah. And we read these words, "The fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon the beast of the earth, upon every bird of the heavens, upon everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are delivered. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. And as I give you the green plants, I give you everything. But you shall not eat the flesh with its life, that is, its blood." Genesis 9, 2 to 4 from the ESV. So God's word indicates that the use of animals and vegetation for human need is ordained by God himself. But there are certain restrictions that God places on the killing of animals for food. For example, in Deuteronomy 22, 6 to 7, we read, and by the way, this is an expansion of this sixth commandment, you must not kill. If you come across a bird's nest in any tree or any of the ground with young ones or eggs, the mother sitting on the young or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. You shall let the mother go, but the young you may take for yourself, that it may go well with you and that you may live long. And then in Leviticus 22, verse 28, we read, "But you shall not kill an ox or a sheep and her young in one day." So both of these verses are an expansion and a further application of this law as given by God in Exodus 20, verse 13, regarding the killing. And so it's important for us to see these things because this law has a much broader application than murder and human life. God is the creator of all life, and his law, therefore, applies to all of life. All right, with that background and understanding, then, let's consider, then, the second and main part of the application of this law, and this point is the killing of human beings. So God speaks to the killing of animals and vegetation. We don't talk about murdering an animal or murdering a plant, but this word and this law and this part of it specifically deals with the subject of human murder. Listen to the following description, the following headlines, front page attention. It was a story of mass murder, along with photos of the unfortunate victims. In the wake of the killings, investigating officials were heard to say things like this: "This is the most horrific thing I've ever seen. They suffered in ways you can't imagine. When we find the killer, he's going to be the kind of person who has no conscience." Now, whose death do you suppose prompted that kind of outpouring of shock and anger? Was it a bunch of tourists who were slain by terrorists in some Middle Eastern country? Was it school children who were victims of a school shooting? No. No. The victims were 33 free-range horses. They were gunned down, and this goes back some years ago, in a canyon just 10 miles north of Reno, Nevada. The killings were attributed to some Marines who were home on holiday who used their training and skills to kill these horses. Now, Marine officials were equally outraged over what their own troops had done, these senseless, brutal killings, the calculated, cold-blooded taking of life. Now, so much for those headlines. Certainly, there's an emotional reaction to that that's quite understandable. And as we have seen, God's law indeed has something to say about the killing of animals. But you know what is most interesting, and the reason I share this with you, is the way that in our modern times we get so worked up about cruelty to animals. And I'm not saying cruelty to animals is good or it's acceptable. Of course it isn't. But yet the problem is atrocities against human beings often leave the average person indifferent and unmoved. We have so much news about rage and school shootings and terrorism and everyday violence on the streets that people are becoming desensitized to the news reports of murder. You combine that with the brutally violent movies and video games and these autopsy shows and emergency room shows. The sober reality is that Americans seem to be people who have no regard for human life. The consequences of moving away from God's law and His way of life are clearer now than at any other time. In Proverbs 8, a passage that is well worth remembering, Proverbs 8:36, God declares, "All they that hate me," and the "me" there is God's wisdom, God's way of life, "all they that hate me are in love with death." Friends, I want you to consider this, the importance of God's law. In the founding of these United States was of singular importance to our ancestors. Listen carefully to these words from John Adams, our second president, and certainly among our founding fathers. Now, he said this regarding the original colonies that made up the original states of these United States. He says, "We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion." He says, "Our Constitution is designed only for a moral and religious people. It is completely inadequate for any other." End of quote. You realize what the man has said? He has said that the government of these United States cannot and was never intended to try to deal with unbridled or human passion or human morality that is not in subservience to God's law. So the people who made up the founding of this nation all agreed in a contract, I don't mean a formally written contract, but it was sort of understood, we will govern ourselves and our families first and foremost by the law of God, as summarized in these Ten Commandments. And we have a constitution that gives us procedural law, but it's designed only for people who govern themselves first and foremost by God's law. He says it's simply not adequate to govern anyone, any other type of people. Now, I share that with you to show the importance that he lays on God's law, but also as an explanation of why things are the way they are today as I speak these words. Let me relate to you something, a following true story, as a means of showing how on a broad scale the ripple effects of our death-obsessed culture shows up in the most unlikely places. Now, this will have some relevance to those of us here in South Carolina. Alex Sanders, maybe a few of you know that name, but he served as a chief judge of the South Carolina Court of Appeals from 1983 to 1992. He's from Columbia. And he told this story about his daughter Zoe. When she was 3 years old, Judge Sanders came home from his work to find a crisis in his household. Little Zoe's pet turtle had died, and she was crying her heart out. Now, her mother, who had coped with the problems of the home all day, promptly dropped this issue into her husband's lap and encouraged him, in so many words, to go console the daughter. Well, at that time in his life, Judge Sanders was a practicing law attorney and serving in the South Carolina State Legislature as a state senator. And he said that he felt that this was a problem, to use our more modern language, that as a politician, as an attorney, was simply beyond his pay grade. The task of explaining the mysteries of life and death to a three-year-old were completely beyond his confidence or experience. But he tried. First thing he did was tell the daughter, "Listen, honey, tell you what, we're going to go down to the pet store tomorrow and we're going to get another turtle just like the one that died." Well, he got nowhere with that. I mean, even a three-year-old, Zoe, was smart enough to know that a turtle is not a toy, and there's no such thing as simply going down to the pet store and buying exactly one like the one that died. And so she continued to weep and be sorrowful. And finally, in his desperation, Senator Sanders said, "Well, I'll tell you what, we'll have a funeral for the turtle." Well, being a three-year-old, she had no idea what a funeral was, so he tried to explain that. He said, "Well, it's a great festival in honor of your turtle." Well, she didn't know what a festival was. And so he quickly proceeded to explain further. Actually, he said, "A funeral is sort of like a birthday party." "Yes," he said, "we'll have ice cream and lemonade and balloons, and all your little friends from the neighborhood can come over and play." Well, at that, things took a decidedly more positive and upbeat turn for the little girl. Zoe's tears began to dry, and she quickly returned to her happy, smiling self. Now she was happy and joyous at the prospect of all that was going to happen, a big party with a cake and ice cream, all because the turtle had died. All because the turtle had died. Then something utterly unforeseen happened. As they looked down at the little turtle, lo and behold, the turtle began to move. He was not dead at all. And in a matter of seconds, he was crawling about as lively as ever, like nothing had ever happened. Well, the little girl appraised the situation very quickly, and with all the innocence of her tender years, she looked up at her father and said, "Daddy, let's kill it." Now, that true story certainly has an element of humor in it. But you know, there's something about it that's very disturbing. You don't know whether really to laugh or to say, "Well, wait a minute." I mean, I seriously doubt that a three-year-old girl had been watching blood-soaked TV documentaries or playing violent, brutal video games, but even at her age, she bore all the marks of a fallen humanity that focuses on selfishness and gratification to the detriment of life. And given the fact that each human being begins life with that frame of mind, you can understand how all of the conduits of violence in our society only serve to worsen an already bad situation. Now, in the order of things, this is the second law of the last six commandments. And these are meant to teach us something, as we have had occasion to mention before, about relating to each other. Now, it's not my intention here, as we bring this part to a close, it's not my intention to present you this morning a complex lecture on the finer points of the commandment to "you must not kill" and all the, you know, the different judicial definitions and variations of the shades of murder. Those are matters of very great complexity when, for example, say someone is killed by accident. No, today I just want to focus on the clear-cut matter of the taking away of life of another person unjustly. And the next thing that I want to say about that is the value of human life. You know, if you do even a brief survey of history, you'll find that human life has not been valued in many cultures, perhaps most. When the Lord gave this commandment, for example, human sacrifice was common. And at times, we know this from what Scripture teaches itself, apart from cultural studies of pagan antiquity, parents would even sacrifice their own children out of a sense of religious obligation and duty. The Israelites, for their part, well, we know they'd been slaves in Egypt for centuries. And any culture that would unjustly enslave people obviously doesn't value human life. In many cultures of the world, human beings have been viewed by the powerful and the oligarchs and the rulers and the government as just a renewable resource. those in charge, and then let's say we'll focus on the Roman Empire. The Romans, the leadership of Rome, the Senate, the emperors, well, they had mineral resources like coal and precious metals that they had to mine and use for various purposes. But those were not renewable. That's why Rome was always expanding its boundaries, because it needed more tax money from conquered people and it needed more non-renewable resources. But you see, they also had human resources. See, the difference is that humans can have babies, and so they are renewable, a renewable resource, so to speak, and so therefore they can be expendable. Well, it's into that kind of world that God introduces the idea that human life is valuable. According to God's law, human beings are worth something other than what they produce or the work that they do or the offspring they bear. In fact, people have value even if they do none of those things. Now, the Hebrew word here, as I mentioned earlier, has a specific reference to the killing of another human being. It conveys the idea of premeditation and the intention to destroy another person's life. Now, later we may have occasion to consider those occasions or those situations where another person's life may be taken justifiably. But for now, let's focus on what would lead a person to kill someone for unjust reasons, according to God's law. Well, one might be unrighteous anger. Unrighteous anger. Let me relate to you the first of two baseball stories I want to share with you today. In his autobiography, the former New York Yankees manager and player Billy Martin told about hunting in Texas with his teammate Mickey Mantle. Seems that Mickey Mantle had a good friend who owned this large tract of land in Texas, and he would let Mickey and some of his baseball friends go hunting on the land. So Billy Martin and Mickey Mantle arrived at the ranch, and Mickey told Billy to wait in the car while he went in and checked in with his friend. So Mantle checked in with his friend, who of course quickly gave them permission to go hunting, but he said, "You know, Mickey, I've got a favor to ask of you this time. I've got an old pet mule out there in the barn. The poor thing has gone blind, and I just don't have the heart to put it down. I don't have the heart to execute it." And so he asked Mickey Mantle, "Look, you're here, you got the shotguns, you're going hunting. Would you mind disposing of that mule for me?" Well, on his way back, Mickey Mantle decided that he'd have some fun with his teammate. And so, not saying anything about that conversation, he pretended to be extremely angry and agitated. He scowled and he got in the car and slammed the door. And Billy Martin asked him what was wrong. And Mickey Mantle said his friend refused to let them go hunting. He said, "I'm so mad at that guy, I'm going out to his barn and I'm going to shoot one of his mules." And Mantle floored the car and did donut cuts around to the barn. And Billy Martin's going, "Wait, you can't do that." But Mantle was adamant, "No, sir, you just watch me." Well, when he got to the barn, he jumped out of the car, pulled out his rifle, ran inside, and shot the mule. And as he was leaving, he heard two shots ring out as he runs back to the car, and he sees Billy Martin had taken out his rifle too, and he says, "You know what?" He said, "What in the world are you doing, Martin?" He said, "We're going to show that guy. I just killed two of his cows." Well, there are, of course, times maybe when we should be angry. I don't think that joke helps us much in terms of understanding that. We should be angry. We should be indignant when people are unjustly abused, for example. That's usually what we call righteous anger. When we see someone who is bona fide being horribly, horribly treated, physically or some other way. And so it's focused on the problem of someone else. But unrighteous anger is self-focused. It is anger that has its origins in our selfishness and our self-centeredness. It is inappropriate for the follower of Jesus Christ to be unrighteously angry. James chapter 1, verses 19 to 20 teaches us, "Know this, my beloved brothers, let every person be quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. For the anger of man does not produce the righteousness of God." But you see, anger is not the only thing that may lead someone to take away another life unjustly. The next thing is a false worldview. So, let me be more specific. There's some religions that promote the idea that the best thing that can be done to someone who rejects their belief system is to kill them. And don't think I'm just talking about Muslim jihadists. They may be included in that. I wonder how many of you know the total numbers of people who have been slaughtered in the past century by communist governments. Communist governments. Everybody gets all worked up about the Nazis and the Holocaust. That's fine. You should get worked up about that. And let's agree that 6 million people were killed by the Nazis. Upwards of 100 million people or more were murdered by the communists in places like communist China and the former Soviet Union and communist nations in Southeast Asia. If you know your religious history, you know something about the Protestant Reformation, I assume. Do you realize that there are Protestant ancestors of ours who were murdered, who were killed because they would not accept the beliefs of the Roman Catholic Church? You see, friends, ideas have consequences. And one reason killing was so common in the ancient pagan world was because of their worldview, their philosophy of life. In terms of more modern times, I want you to listen to this statement. I'm not going to tell you who said this, but just listen to this. This is a very recent statement. Quote, killing a defective human infant is not morally equivalent to killing a person. Sometimes it's not wrong at all. I hope you're getting the full import of that. This was said by Professor Peter Singer, age 74, formerly professor at the University of Melbourne in Australia. He has been teaching, get this now, bioethics at Princeton University since, I think, around the year 2000. He is considered the father of the international animal rights movement. He has said that children less than a month old have no human consciousness and do not have the same rights as others. And so here is a man teaching college students who believe that an animal has more of a right to life than a one-month-old baby with a physical handicap. What would lead a university professor to believe such a thing and to teach others to believe the same? Well, the answer is simple. His worldview, his philosophy of life. See, in the Bible, we're taught that human life is to be seen as uniquely connected to God in a way that no other life is. We are made in His image. Each of us bears the image of God that makes us unique. And the Lord placed so much value on human life that He Himself became human in order to restore us to Himself. Therefore, we must hold as an uncompromising truth that human life is worthwhile and valuable. Worthwhile and valuable. My second baseball reference today. Some of you may remember the name of Mark McGwire. He played for the Oakland Athletics, and some years ago, he hit a record-breaking 72 home runs in one season. Well, you may be shocked to learn. Now, there's more to it than that, but I'll just leave it at that right now in terms of the record. But you may be shocked to learn that the baseball that he hit out of the park that day sold on the collector's market for $2.7 million. You know, there are probably millions of baseballs in the world, but this one was worth $2.7 million because it was associated with Mark McGwire and what he did. Now, on the other side, there are millions and millions of people in the world today, too. Why? Why are they valuable? What makes them so valuable? You know, if somebody was to take that collector's item, baseball, and say, erase the trademark from it, or somehow remove the threads and the seams of the baseball, well, it would no longer be the same. But humans are not like baseballs. The image of God in man cannot be erased. Men and women have value because they bear the mark, the image of God. As most of us know, that's not a very popular idea in the world we live in today. Hasn't been for a long time. Because we've lost a sense of the value of human life in our culture. Our world sees life as something being formed as an accident of nature. That's the theory. Human beings are the end process. That's the theory. We are the culmination of a process that began from the random collision of chemicals and energy. And according to this theory of evolution, human evolution, those who are the most fit will survive while the weak will pass away. With God and His law written out of the equation, you see, then humanity cannot be made in His image, and therefore we are considered to be no different than any other type of creature. Animals are then raised to a human level. That's why people are more in love with their pets today than they are with their own children. Animals are raised to a human level, and humans are lowered to that of animals. But if you begin with and maintain the biblical worldview, then God is the absolute final measure of all things. But if you maintain the view that nature and evolution are absolute and the final measures of all things, then there's no basis at all for a belief in human worth and value. God says every individual is valuable no matter who they are or what they do for a living. Some years ago, there was a woman who was pursuing a career as a nurse. And in her early years in nursing school, she told of something that happened that she never forgot. During her second month of nursing school, the professor of this particular class gave the students a quiz. And the last question on that quiz really stumped every student in that class. The question read this way: what is the first name of the cleaning woman who cleans the school? Well, all the students had seen the cleaning woman several times. She was tall, dark-haired, in her 50s, but how would any of them know her name? And before the class ended, one student raised their hand and asked a question about that last, or raised an issue about that last question and said, does this count toward our grade? Absolutely it does, said the professor. He said, in your careers, you will meet many people. All are significant. They deserve your attention and your care, even if all you do is smile and say hello. Well, I can assure you the students in that class never forgot that lesson, and all of them learned the name of that cleaning lady. You shall not kill. Let us remember this side and this part of God's law. Let us pray.